Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here's your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome to the show Texas Christian University professor, Dr. Darren Middleton. He's a native of Nottingham, England. He's a honors faculty fellow and professor of religion at said university. He's published 10 books, including Approaching Silence, which we reviewed in last week's show. It's a wonderful show on that subject, based on the book by Suzaku Endo called Silence. His latest book, though, is entitled, talk about a shift in focus. His latest book is entitled Rastafari and the Arts, and is today's subject on World Spirituality. So it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the show, Darren, Professor Darren Middleton. Welcome back.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's good to be here.
You know, I must say I thoroughly enjoyed this book on Rastafari. You know, it's number one, it's approachable. It flows. In fact, I read it pretty much in one sitting. I couldn't stop reading it. It's impeccably argued and is a seemingly effortless distillation of a vast body of work. And it comes across very compellingly, at least it did for me. It covers the basics of Rastafari culture and religion, and its most well-known product, perhaps, which is music, especially reggae. But then we're also introduced to the literary art and poetry of Rasta, and also documentary films about Rasta, and then a discussion of some Rasta communities. We think most frequently of Jamaica, but then we find there's Rasta communities also in Ghana and even in Japan, and Darren talks about those. And the book includes Dr. M's Rasta Rhythms playlist, which is over 200 CDs that speak to Darren's vast knowledge of the oeuvre. I couldn't believe it, all those CDs. And they're not the generally the most well-known, too. There's some obscure titles in there. He digs deep. It's fascinating. Darren even touches on Trustafarians, Impostafarians, and the commodifying of the movement. So it's a huge panoply of information and insight. So, wow, where do we start? And I guess we start with your upbringing, because you were influenced by reggae and its various in its various forms, weren't you? When you were a child.
That's right. thank you very much for the very kind and warm summary of the book. It's taken many, many years to put together, and it's in some ways very avocational for me because although I attended three British universities and have done some postdoctoral work as well, I've never officially taken a course in Rastafari studies, as it's known today. though there are more and more universities around the country and then around the globe that are offering courses, if not degrees, in that area. So times have changed. But yes, to come back to your observation about my childhood, and I kind of referenced that at the beginning, I grew up with a great many Rastas. Nottingham is it's in the center of the country. It's a pretty large industrial working class part of the country. And after the Second World War, when the immigration rules in the country were relaxed, a lot of former Commonwealth folk came into the country and settled in those industrial areas like the East Midlands, like Nottingham. And so I found myself attending school and then going to play at the local park and other things, running errands for my mother and father, and running into children of those immigrants who in the early 70s were attracted to Rasta for its social and political and religious sort of undertones. And you're quite right about the reggae. The reggae and art in general is the way in which I came to Rasta. In some ways, the argument of the book is that art is the engine that drives the Rastafari vehicle. And I grew up listening to a whole host of reggae musicians and singers, songwriters. Many of them were local. I could put a local face on reggae. Of course, there is Bob Marley as the global ambassador of the movement, but there were also local acts that I went to see in concert. And, of course, as anyone who was curious about reggae will tell you, after a while, you know, you listen to the reggae music and you start to sort of get curious about the references to this character called Haile Selassie, and you become, I guess, intrigued by the special vernacular or the kind of the peculiar lexicon. The language of I, and Babylon, and Jah Rastafari. And over time, I think people were very kind enough and very patient enough to sort of sit me down and explain some of this music to me. And it just kind of found its way into my soul. I don't know whether it's true, but certainly the tradition is that reggae as a music is more or less in keeping with the natural beat of the heart. And, you know, again, I'm not sure about the biophysics of all of that, but certainly it was able to reach through to me. And as a white kid growing up in Nottingham in the English East Midlands, son of a coal miner, I've taken it from there. It's always been a side interest of mine. One of my first publications was on Rastafari, and here I am, you know, almost 30 years later, still writing about this group. They're endlessly fascinating to me.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I think the same's true in Cardiff, where I grew up. You know, it being a port and a fairly big city, it has a lot of immigrants coming in from the Caribbean and, of course, from India. You know, as you say, after the Second World War, they started coming in the 50s and 60s. And I remember being influenced by what was called Rocksteady back in when I was a teenager. And I think it was before reggae was established. There was this thing called Rocksteady, and a lot of my friends, you know, played that music, and we really enjoyed it. And there was a graffiti actually later in my career there when I was about 20 that it said Jimmy Cliff, and every time I'd pass on the bus that it was Jimmy Cliff, so it imprinted itself in me. I've always loved Jimmy Cliff's music as well. I don't know if it's, you describe it as pure Rasta Jimmy Cliff, but he certainly is one of the folks that popularized it. You know, it was in the movie what is it, The Harder They Come, and so, you know, was one of the folks that brought it to a greater familiarity for regular people. But Rasta, when it, I was interested to read that, you know, Rasta, when it started, like with the commune called Pinnacle, I think, in Jamaica, it was seen by the Jamaicans themselves as a threat, right? And eventually the police burned that commune down. So it's interesting. Now we see it as a, sort of a harbinger of freedom, of independence, of the post-colonial worldview. But at the time, it was seen as a threat even by those who may have wanted independence, which is kind of ironic.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, there are some, not that I do this in my book, and necessarily, but a lot of the scholars have done this, there's parallels between, you know, the development of early Rastafari spirituality, or liberty, as Rastas call it, and the development of earliest Christianity, the way vis-a-vis the authorities, you know, the way in which the social and political governmental leadership of the day kind of looks at this new religious movement and perceives it to be a threat, largely because it's made up of the poor and the underclass, who always have to be seen as a kind of blueprint for social change in any society, really. And, you know, when you add that to the fact that the Rastafari, the early Rastafari, had this rather interesting, fascinating, beguiling physical appearance. I mean, they're not the only religious group in history who have altered their physical appearance and use it as a marker of their religious identity. But there's something about the matted locks, the so-called dreadlocks, which you know, is rooted in scripture, a whole host of scriptural references, that was deeply, deeply threatening to those Jamaican social and political authorities. And you're quite right, that very first commune in St. Catherine, pinnacle in St. Catherine, put together by Leonard Howell, was raided by the police a couple of times in 1948, 1954, respectively. And then what happened is a lot of those Rastas, you know, grew tired of that police brutality, the kind of Babylonian oppression, as they read it. And many of them left St. Catherine and moved into the projects or the tenement areas of Weston Kingston, the trench towns, for example. And then into that area came folk like Jimmy Cliff and Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh and Bob Marley, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Right, yeah, exactly. Which is, again, ironic, isn't it? Because sometimes, you know, those that wish to squelch and end up helping the movement on its way. And I think that happened also in Christianity, and it's happened in other movements too, that if it's meant to flower, it flowers perhaps not just in spite of the oppression, but because of it. And that's certainly the case with Rasta. Just for those who have no understanding, you know, they know reggae maybe, and they know dreadlocks, but they have no understanding of what Rastafari is. How would you describe it? I think that's almost an impossibility because it's so diverse. But what are the core elements, and how did it come into being in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a very complicated, requires a complicated answer, it seems to me. So, right. So I hope you'll bear with me. The first thing I think I'd want to say is that you know, Rastafari themselves, if you ever find yourself talking to a Rasta man or a Rasta woman, they'll very quickly let you know that there's a kind of diversity to the movement, which is not captured if you put ISM on the end of Rastafari. So Rastas will sort of resist the idea that there's Rastafarianism, as though there's this monolithic thing, any more than Hindus will regard Hinduism as something. It's an abstraction. It's a reification. A category mistake in many ways. So the interesting thing I think to do is to actually go back to the beginning and then move forward and show that over 80 short years, the Rastafari has become this international, very global, diverse movement that's made up of lots of different, we might call them denominations, outsiders might call them denominations. Rastas prefer the term mansions. There are groups within Rastafari, just like there are groups within Christianity. And, you know, your average Pentecostal is perhaps quite different from your average Catholic, who's quite different from your average Southern Baptist. So if one can sort of use that analogy, that there's diversity within Christianity, that then perhaps we can be open to the diversity that's in Rastafari. To go back to the beginning, though, you'd have to sort of zero in on two figures. One of them is the black nationalist Marcus Garvey, whose middle name is Mosiah, which has that biblical resonance, that kind of reference or allusion there to Moses as someone who leads his captive people out of slavery and into liberation. Marcus Garvey, of course, was a strong philosopher, a social commentator, very much a back to Africa kind of person, who was much misunderstood in his lifetime. His philosophy and opinions are easy to locate in book form and online. Said many things. He was a fine orator. Not everybody liked what he had to say. In 1928, he made a comment in Kingston that at the time was a little bit of a throwaway comment. I don't think that many people focused on it, but he said, you know, to the crowd that was assembled, "Look to Africa for the crowning of a king, for the day of deliverance is near." So that kind of had a almost Elijah-like or John the Baptist or Moses-like feel to it. And lo and behold, in 1930, Ethiopia, in November of 1930, Ethiopia crowned a new king. His name was Ras Tafari. Ras in Amharic, one of the many languages in Ethiopia, means prince. And Tafari was the family name. And he took a whole host of other names, Ras Tafari did, which is fairly common when someone assumes or is the monarchy or is crowned, then they get a new name. And that new name for him was Haile Selassie, which has in Amharic a lot of biblical resonance as well. It means power or might of the Trinity. What was really fascinating is that the longer version of his name, his Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie I, elect of God, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. Now, that's what's really fascinating, because anyone who's biblically literate would have heard an echo of Revelation chapter 5, verse 5. Revelation is a very, very hard book to decode, and lots of people have tried to do it over the years, of course. But essentially, a lot of traditional Christians will see that reference to the conquering lion of the tribe of Judah as somebody who's in the Davidic line and therefore is the Messiah. Traditional Christians see this as Jesus, who is the only one who is worthy to open up the mystical seven seals that are referenced in the book of Revelation. Rastas, early Rastas, like Leonard Howell, who founded that a commune at Pinnacle that we talked about just a little earlier, he read his scriptures and not just Revelation 5, verse 5, but also Psalm 68 and a whole host of other biblical references. And did what anyone who's interested in the Bible tends to do, and that is they started to piece things together, and before long, to cut a long story short, Haile Selassie was regarded as the Black Christ reincarnated, 225th in line of descent from King Solomon and Queen Sheba, and therefore the promised Messiah, the one that Marcus Garvey was talking about. And in, you know, over 80 short years, the Rastafari have come to look upon Haile Selassie as central to the movement, as God, as Jah Rastafari, Jah being J-A-H, being the Rastafari abbreviation for Jehovah, God, Yahweh, in a way.
Fascinating stuff, isn't it? And, I can't help but think that the, the counterculture hippie movement of the 60s and 70s, helped in some way to solidify, the common understanding of Rasta, because, you mentioned this when you went to interview the reggae outfit there in New Delhi, the Reggae Rajas, that they noted the similarity between, many of the sadhus in India, with their dreadlocks, smoking the same kind of herb that Rastas are often attributed, to smoking, and looking at very amazingly similar and having sort of a ritual purity about them too, a divorce from the world, as an ascetic virtue that is similar to some sects in Rasta. So, it's kind of the interesting commonality that made it a sort of a world view here of a different way of approach. And one of the underpinnings of Rastafari is its iconoclasm, isn't it?
Yes, I think so, and I think you're absolutely right in the sense that societies always shape religions. Religions never appear in a vacuum, of course, and I think there is something about what's happening in Britain, in Europe, in the Caribbean, and elsewhere in the world in the 50s and 60s and 70s that make that create a kind of environment in which Rastafari is welcomed and encouraged to a degree.
Yes.
The other thing is, I think you're right about the connections between the sadhus in India, which is picked up by this the reggae rajas, who are the New Delhi's, if not India's, premier sort of reggae act at the moment. Their star is very much on the rise. They draw attention to this cross-cultural comparison, which I think illustrates for scholars like me the sense that Rastafari is definitely a global faith these days. And deserves to be in a discussion of other global faiths, and like Christianity, is remarkably adept at cultural change and social change. Wherever it finds itself, it adapts to its environment, and as we all know from Darwin, if an organism is to survive, it's got to do that, and if it's to flourish, it's got to adapt to its environment. Rastafari has an amazing capacity to do that.
All right, we have to adapt to the show, which has a break right now, so unfortunately we've got to stop. But we'll be back in 2 minutes and talk more about Rastafari, their brethren and sistren. So come back and listen to some more in a couple of minutes. Join us then.
If Unity Online Radio has helped you grow spiritually through programs like this one, please consider supporting this online radio programming. Visit www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Thank you for helping us continue to serve as the voice of an awakening world.
Daily Word. Inspiration, and practical teachings to help people of all faiths live healthy, prosperous, and meaningful lives.
My mind and body are in an ongoing conversation. My body responds to my thoughts, and my mind continually receives messages from my body, especially when something is out of order. However, I am more than mind and body. I am created in the image and likeness of God. I am first and foremost spirit. As I bring my spiritual awareness into the conversation between mind and body, I keep myself in balance. I know my body and its needs. I nurture it with food and water, rest and exercise. I also send an affirmation of life and renewal to every cell of my being. With spirit-centered thoughts, words, and actions, I claim my true identity as a whole and healthy expression of God, mind, body, and spirit.
Daily Word magazine is now available in a digital format. To learn how you can subscribe to this online interactive magazine, go to www.dailyword.com.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Professor Darren Middleton, and we're talking about his avocation, which is the study of the Rastafari movement, and he's written a book called Rastafari and the Arts. It covers, like we said, a vast range of subject matter, from novels to poetry to music to the underpinnings of the Rasta belief, to the sheer variety of Rastafari understanding, because I don't think it's something you can pin down and easily. It's very varied, and one of the most fascinating things about the book is that Darren has conducted in-depth interviews with many of the key players in Rasta, and that makes it really come alive. And as we were just sharing in the break, you know, it's one thing to be an outsider who's fascinated with this movement, but it's another thing to be an insider who is a Rasta. And I found all of the interviews very, very compelling. And one of the ones I want to focus on, though, is with the interesting young chap, Benjamin Zephaniah, who's one of my favorites, because he's put out some very cool videos on YouTubes. And you interview him. I thought his insights onto Snoop Doggy Dog, who's now Snoop Lion, having become a convert to Rasta, was very insightful. And Benjamin Zephaniah, you know, has put out a video that's one of my favorites. It's called "I Must Be Listening to the Wrong Radio Station," which I suggest you get hold of. Just go on YouTube and pull that up, because it's absolutely brilliantly done. It's very funny, but it's very insightful about modern society as well. So let's talk about him, because he turned down an OBE, didn't he?
That's right. He did. Famously, during the when Tony Blair was the British Prime Minister, yes, he turned down an honour in the Queen's honours list, the OBE. For those of your listeners who do not know, it's the Order of the British Empire. It's an honour that's usually bestowed upon a range of individuals, really, just ordinary citizens sometimes, who have devoted long hours for community service of some description. Sometimes it's given to sports stars who have put England on the cultural map, and sometimes musicians as well. And the way the process usually works is that the Prime Minister kind of sounds out the representatives of the more famous individuals, the actors and so on, you know, asks whether they would agree to have their name put forward. And I think they did this with Benjamin Zephaniah. And, of course, he used the moment as a teaching moment, because if you sort of go back to what OBE stands for, Order of the British Empire, and then you think about what empire might mean to children of immigrants, or a son of immigrants from former Commonwealth countries, then you're implicated in some of that history, which perhaps has some good sides to it, but also some not so good sides to it. And so what Benjamin Zephaniah did was what he always does, what he's become famous for, which is to be a very good, very powerful, and a poignant and insightful social cultural critic. And he turned it down. He alerted people to the reasons for turning it down, and a lot of those reasons had to do with how uncomfortable it would be for him as a child of immigrants, as a Rasta man, as someone who equates Babylon with empire and with imperialism and its nefarious side, to accept something in the name of empire. So he turned it down, took an awful lot of criticism for doing so, but an awful lot of other people were very appreciative. Now, you know, I balance that somewhat, because elsewhere in the book I also talk about the female Rasta poet Jean Binter Breeze, who only last year, I think, was awarded the MBE, a member of the British Empire, and she accepted that and went to Buckingham Palace to receive that honour. So different Rastas feel differently about the same issues sometimes. Remarkable how that diversity shows up.
Well, we see the same thing with John Lennon, don't we? The Beatles received an MBE back in the mid-60s, and with the radicalization of Lennon, you know, towards the end of that decade, he decided to return it, you know, to make a statement, because he saw it as, you know, kind of cultural imperialism, I guess. And you could see it as a symbolic honor now that has nothing to do with the British Empire, simply because there is no British Empire in reality, but, so it's just a name, but I can see both sides. It would be hard though if you spend your whole career, you know, being an iconoclast to then accept, you know, an award by the establishment, because, you know, it could be interpreted as selling out. Though there's many iconoclastic rock musicians, you know, who are now knighted, you know, Sir Mick Jagger or whatever, and it still sounds a little weird to think that you know, Mick Jagger, this anti-establishment figure, is now knighted. I understand he's quite at home in the establishment now, but it's part of this commodifying, isn't it, of a movement. You know, once the publicists get hold of it, you know, the most radical idea can become very lame very quickly, because it's been welcomed by the machine, if you like, and so, you know, he's taken a stand against that, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And it's not like he hadn't traveled that road before. I mean, in the I think in the late 1990s, he was a candidate for Britain's Poet Laureate, which is which is a kind of an honorific title and position. I think they give you, I don't know, a case of sherry every year, or maybe £50, something like that. But the most interesting part about it is that it, at royal occasions, the Poet Laureate is supposed to, of course, compose and then recite a poem as a kind of eulogy or some kind of encomia for a royal personage. And at one point, I think Benjamin Zephaniah lost out by maybe a handful of votes to Andrew Motion.
Right,
who,
exactly.
within a couple of years, I think, found himself having to compose and then recite a poem for the passing of the Queen Mother, who's a much revered figure if you think about, you know, all that she stood for during the Blitz and so on in London. A much revered figure, just imagine, in the mind's eye, just imagine what would that have looked like if instead of Andrew Motion, you had a dreadlock rasta man eulogizing the Queen Mum on her passing. That would tell you a great deal about how far the Rastas had come. If the police degraded the commune in Pinnacle in 1948, but by, you know, the early 2000s, a Rasta man in Britain was standing up and eulogizing the passing of the Queen Mother, that would tell you how far and how rapidly that movement had changed.
Absolutely. I mean, even to get shortlisted is quite interesting, you know, even if because I think he was shortlisted for the professorship of poetry at Oxford, wasn't he, at one time? And now he is a professor, isn't he, at Brunel University?
That's right.
So, you know, he has been elevated into that quasi-establishment position.
Right.
You know, so that's interesting how that can happen. Are you okay with that, personally?
Personally?
Yeah.
You know, I think commodification of religion is almost inevitable. I mean, the insiders make a religion what it is, of course, or a faith what it is, but also outsiders make it in part what it is. If you think about how it's, you know, Hollywood producers and Hollywood movie makers shape the Christian imagination around Jesus and the apostles and the first Christians as much as preachers do on any given Sunday. You know, it's the Martin Scorsese, he's the Mel Gibsons of this world. Or I noticed that Easter Sunday, the AD program is going to be on, which will be telling us about those first few years after Jesus' death. You know, media can shape, of course. It's almost you know, a hackneyed observation, but let me make it. Media shapes the religious imagination, and those who control the media are, for the most part, outsiders to a religion. And the media shapes the Christian imagination. The media these days also shapes the Rastafari imagination, or our sense of what the Rastafari stand for. You know, it's amazing. A lot of my students, when they come into the first day of my class on Rastafari, a lot of them think of Bob Marley as this, Caribbean equivalent of Jimmy Buffett. You know, he's all about peace and love and strolling rather carefree down the sun-flecked beach, and it's all about smoking marijuana and good times and peace and love. There's a lot more to it than that, as you and I both know, and as I hope my book actually makes clear.
Right. I want to be I want to play the devil's advocate for a moment and suggest that, you know, if you put a patois, an interesting accent on a poem, and you declaim it in a certain way, you know, no matter how bad that poem is, it has a certain cachet that say another person, an Anglo, getting up and speaking the same words would not have. And so in a sense, maybe this is being horribly politically incorrect. I don't know. But I get that feeling sometimes, you know, and that this doesn't just apply to Rastas, but to anyone who stands up with some kind of, countercultural vibe going on, you know, is listened to a little more than maybe other worthy candidates who don't have the accent or don't have the chutzpah to do it in the first place. So you know, that concerns me a little bit about our plaudits that we give to folks who are a little arresting because of the different accent or the different use of vocabulary. Is there any validity to that?
I'm sure there is. I mean, I'm sure that comment has been made in some scholarship and by, you know, those who've attended, let's say, a poetry reading by Rastas. I think there's, you know, as with the study of any poetry, you know, you can find good poets and bad poets, or weak poets and strong poets. And I think, characters like Benjamin Zephaniah, Jean Bintebreeze, and others that I talk about in my book have a real they kind of have a love-hate relationship with, a ferocious ambiguity toward standard English and toward what we might call the sound and sense of traditional poetry. There's a sense in which they recognize the value of the Byrons and the Yeatses and the Wordsworths and so on. But they also feel the need to go beyond them. So they don't, in the sense that they don't want to feel hemmed in by, you know, what constitutes a decent poem. You know, I've yet to find a Rastafari sonnet, for example, because there's just not. It's not that there's an inattention to that. I just think there are other things that are higher up the list of priorities, as it were. Having said that, one of the very first TV programs that Benjamin Zephaniah put out was a really creative program for British Channel 4 TV, and it was called The Dread Poets Society, which is a nice kind of play on the film of that name. And what it involves is Benjamin Zephaniah interviewing in this kind of mystical, fictional way all the famous English romantic poets of old, you know, the Byrons and the Keats and the Shelleys and so on. And it was Zephaniah's way of saying, you know, we have some things in common. We are British, we are English, we are born of this green and pleasant land, but there's different issues here to be dealing with, and we live in different times, and different times require a different sound and a different sense, you will. And so, you know, having seen Benjamin in concert a few times, and having also, like you, seen him on YouTube many times, and I really do encourage your listeners to check him out. You can get a sense of somebody who feels the anxiety of influence. I mean, he knows there are many great poets in British cultural history who've gone before him. He feels that anxiety, but he doesn't as well. He also feels that he's adding to that long and distinguished tradition of British poetry. and in that sense is his own person.
Right. Yeah, and it's very compelling because it's quite visceral. You know, it's similar to you know, some hip hop and rap in America that cuts to the chase. It dares to make social comments, whereas a more erudite poetic tradition, you know, sort of steers away from that. So it cuts right through to the heart of things. I was just thinking the irony here is that the only poet I know of in a more erudite English tradition that uses dialect is Kipling, you know, which is an imperialist poet par excellence, or at least he's been characterized in such a way. But other poets have, you know, attempted to use dialect. I'm thinking of people like John Clare, who was a country poet, using the dialect. Thomas Hardy did to a degree. And there's a refreshing quality to that, I think. And this, it's certainly refreshing to hear what Benjamin Zephaniah comes across with, because it's hard-hitting, but it's also amusing at the same time. And therefore, it scores greatly, I think.
Yes, and I think it's important to point out that whenever Benjamin Zephaniah sits down, if he sits at all, because he's such an energetic character.
Yeah, he's hyperkinetic.
He doesn't work with the page in mind. So he's right. Not like a traditional poet. I mean, he doesn't sort of hole himself up in quiet sort of solitudinal places and away from the hustle and bustle of life, and then sit down with ink and pen and a piece of paper in hand and write his poems that way. He sees himself as a performance poet. A lot of Rastafari poets see themselves as performance poets, and so they're working with the stage rather than the page in mind. And to see Benjamin Zephaniah in concert sort of moving back and forth, prowling across the stage with, you know, flashing his dreadlocks is to have a sense of a kind of an old, almost like an Old Testament prophet come to life, and you know, like a Jeremiah or an Ezekiel, you know, full of fantastic visions and social denunciations, is taking on what he sees as a kind of a modern day Babylon.
Yes, absolutely. And for those of us who are listening, you're not sure what that Babylon reference, it's a kind of catch-all for all kinds of power structures, right? And the man, if you like, it's another name for the man.
Absolutely.
This idea of all the evils of the domination system, I guess, of the establishment, whatever that might represent for each of us. All right, we're at the break. I'm with Dr. Darren Middleton. We're talking about his book Rastafari and the Arts. We'll be back to talk some more after these messages from Unity. Join us in a couple of minutes.
Now and then, life is challenging. I may not welcome challenge itself, but I welcome the opportunity to learn from whatever arises, to grow in understanding, to flex my spiritual muscles. Every day is a new day, a fresh start. No situation or circumstance can hold me back. My life is not only about what's happening to me, it's also what's happening through me. The Christ within is my source of unlimited wisdom and creativity. I do my best when I respond to any challenge from my Christ nature, rather than reacting impulsively from my human nature. Every day I pursue what enriches me, enjoying the journey to my goals as much as the destination.
This inspirational message is brought to you by Daily Word. Daily Word. Inspiration and practical teachings to help people of all faiths live healthy, prosperous, and meaningful lives. Give Daily Word to yourself or a friend, and give the gift of hope, joy, peace, and encouragement. Order your subscriptions today online at dailyword.com.
If I were brave, I'd walk the razor's edge, where fools and dreamers dare to tread and never lose faith.
How is life working for you? Would it be okay with you if life got easier, simpler, yet more meaningful and vibrant? Join certified life coach Carla McClellan Tuesday afternoons for Vibrant Living. Each week, Coach Carla and her guests will share strategies and solutions designed to make your life more vibrant. Is there something in your life you'd like help with? A dream you'd like to achieve? A relationship you'd like to improve? Call into the show toll-free for Coaching with Carla. That's Vibrant Living, Life Coaching with Carla. Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Central on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
What if we're all meant to do what we secretly dream?
Now back to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. We're talking about Rastafari and the arts with Professor Darren Middleton, and we covered quite an interesting variety of subjects, but we've only covered a tiny, tiny bit of the whole of what Rasta is, and it's hard to know where to go next. One of the things is, where is Rasta going? Because it's alive and well. I think it says in the book there's between half a million and a million adherents around the world. But more than that, it's an idea, isn't it? An idea in the minds of people that is sometimes actually visualized in form, you know, by what you call Trustafarians or Impostafarians, people who wear the dreadlocks, who espouse a sort of a peace-love message. Maybe they smoke a little dope. Maybe they listen to the music, but they love the sort of the attitude, the iconoclastic breakout from society that is represented by Rasta. So the danger is that, you know, they buy into the looks rather than the what's really going on. But that's an age old battle, isn't it? As we said, the commodifying of anything, you know, the machine taking over the idea and using it for its own purposes, and then even Rasta's using that for their purposes too. I think you've mentioned in the book Bob Marley, you know, the family, the Bob Marley family is now working with capitalism.
Yeah, that's just one of the more interesting features of contemporary Rastafari. They are going in lots of different directions, and as I mentioned a little earlier, insiders and outsiders are shaping the movement. But that's true, I think, of a lot of religions, and a social scientist would acknowledge that. Insiders might have their grumblings and their misgivings about outsiders shaping what really should be an insider thing, but Rasta is what Rasta does. And Rasta does lots of many different things, just as Christianity does, as Hinduism does, and that makes it real hard to sort of answer a question. Well, what is the true Rasta? Well, Rasta is what Rasta does, and it does lots of many different things. And you know what it's doing at the moment is some really fascinating things when it comes to marketing and venturing. And I choose that term quite deliberately. Venturing to work with the corporate capitalistic world, which earlier Rastas would have equated with Babylon. What's truly, truly fascinating to me is how the global ambassador of Rastafari, Bob Marley, who, of course, you know, we just came through what would have been his 70th birthday, and we get this opportunity to look back and sort of, you know, what is his legacy? Well, you know, one answer to that question would be to draw attention to what the Bob Marley family, what the estate of Bob Marley is up to these days. And those who were paying attention to the news last year know that the Marley family is now working with venture capitalists, the very folk that Bob Marley would have bewailed many, many years ago in some of his songs, working with them to sort of partner on the marketing of marijuana, which not for all Rastas. Benjamin Zephaniah doesn't smoke marijuana, for example, and often gets the criticism, well, you're not really a true Rasta, but he doesn't smoke it. But so not all Rastas sort of smoke weed. But the Marley family is actually, you know, partnering with folk to market this. They've already done some of it. If you go down to your local 7-Eleven store or any gas station, you can usually find the Bob Marley equivalent of Red Bull, which is actually it does the very opposite effect. It kind of slows you down and mellows you out, and it's actually called Marley's Mellow Mood. It's an all natural or Ital drink that you can buy that kind of is a natural sleeping aid or a natural relaxant. But it's another example of how Rastafari is now working with rather than against the very agencies that it so often bewailed in its early history. So it's a sign of where this thing is going. Not all insiders approve of that. Some have suggested that, look, you know, you have to, you can't, Babylon's not going to go away. You've got to work with it rather than against it. And I guess, you know, the parallel there is with Christianity. At some point, it had to work with the Roman Empire in order to not just to survive, but also to flourish. And, you know, that's probably another program. But, you know, you're seeing Rask. Emerge in some new and fascinating ways.
Yes. Is it going to survive?
I think so. I think there'll always be, you know, a kind of a need, yeah, and we certainly see that in this country, there'll always be a need for a philosophy come religion or spirituality that is not just a protest against the authorities. That's usually what how Rasta is understood, is this iconoclastic social protest movement. It's actually a lot more than that. I think it's actually a reclamation of black somebody-ness, which sounds rather fancy. It's really a way of saying, look, it actually gives black women and men a renewed sense of personhood. It actually, the idea that a black god who's testified in scripture, who's a very important part of African history, the cradle of civilization. If you put all of that together, to read that as a black woman or as a black man is actually to read something of your value and your worth as a black woman and as a black man. And I think there'll always be a need for Rastafari in that respect. Rastafari is a reclamation of self and cultural agency that has been denied and continues to be denied by Babylon.
And it's done in a way that, for some reason, you know, the Anglo world is okay with, isn't it? You know, I think movements like Nation of Islam or the Black Panthers and some other traditions like that, you know, are seen as very threatening. But for some reason, Rastafari is not seen as so threatening. It's seen as a, like you say, not just the happy-go-lucky thing, but it's seen as a welcoming, embracing alternative. You know, that you could be part of too. And the music is joyous in general. It's an expression of buoyancy and possibility, and I think that's what makes it so attractive. So I think this has that going for it, and of course that's easier to commodify too. But, you know, also because it's very, it morphs a lot, it's very flexible, that's probably a saving grace. You know, it can never be pinned down. So when you think you've got it, you know, in a bottle, so to speak, you know, it slips out and creates a new form. And I think all the best movements, you know, are like that. I think of our own unity movement, you know, which is in a mystical tradition that goes back to, you know, the beginning of Christianity, and yet it's very flexible. It can't be pinned down, and that's one of the things that we're discussing in our movement is, you know, when did we become a commodity? When did we become a doctrinal system? Methodists, for instance, you know, were very radical, weren't they, in the 18th century, and now they're kind of, you know, establishment church. So it's an interesting study, you know, about how things go through natural cycles and then reinvent themselves, and et cetera. And I think, you know, I get the feeling that, you know, Rasta is vital enough to resist being commodified.
Yeah, I think it's got an internal dynamism, right? It's been there from the earliest few years of the movement, a kind of resistance to orthodoxy, to established authorities. It's what social scientists call an acephalous movement from a word that simply means it doesn't have any head. I think that's going to have to change. A lot of Rasta scholars and a lot both inside and outside the movement are, you know, very interested in the notion of the centralization of the Rastafari movement.
Right.
And the installation of a leader who would change over time, of course. There have been leaders in some of the Rastafari mansions or denominations, but those have come and gone, and you know, then the groups have found themselves in a post-charismatic state. Well, who becomes the next leader, and how do we choose them, and so on, and do we really need a leader? But the Rastafari centralization movement is really sort of picking up. An interesting case, you know, just to take us back to the whole issue of the Rastafari and the arts, an interesting case is, I think, the reggae musician Sizzler kind of announced himself as a leader of the Rastafari movement, and that caused an awful lot of internal finger-wagging and denunciation. The Rastafari were pretty much divided for several months last year, where many decried the idea that somebody could set themselves up as a leader. They don't have a pope, we don't have a presiding bishop, we don't have anything like that, and that's a good thing, they would say. They're non-conformist or free church, if you want the analogy, in that respect. But I think at some point in the future, they're going to have to think about centralization.
Yeah. Folks, it's been fascinating to talk with Darren about this subject. If you want to get the book, it's available, it's just come out. And it's called Rastafari and the Arts. And it goes into a lot of detail. There's a lot of fascinating information. And just to get hold of that list of CDs that are available there, that playlist is quite fascinating. There's many other resources available. And like I said, the interviews are golden in the book, too. Let me tell you about next week's show. Next week, Susan Reeve joins me, and she's going to discuss her new book. It's called The Wholehearted Life, Big Changes and Greater Happiness, Week by Week. So that should be helpful for us. But right now, I want to thank Darren for being on the show and sharing his enthusiasm for this fascinating subject. Thank you, Darren.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it very much.
And thanks, folks, for listening, and we'll see you all next week. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Ever find yourself stuck? Slow down and breathe. Bring to mind a person who you admire. Ask yourself, what actions would they take? Would they make a list of possibilities? How about making a list of the things that they're grateful for? Here's another. Reaching out and asking the person you admire for guidance. Finding yourself stuck is similar to being in a dark room with messengers of fear invading your goodness. Pick yourself up, cut a hole in that wall, and let the light in today. Get more inspiration. Listen to Clarity 101 with Glenda Gibbs on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Central Time. Take the first step. You're worth it.
In quiet moments of prayer, let go of any concern. Anchor your trust deep in the realization that with God, all things are possible. Never doubt it for a single moment.
This meditative moment is brought to you by Unity.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.